and thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2021, and this is episode 237, which is a conversation about faith, fact, and reason as ingredients for knowledge. Today's guest is Jonah Haddad, who has an MA in Philosophy of Religion from Denver Seminary and is a PhD candidate at the University of Aberdeen, where he's conducting research in epistemology and skepticism. Jonah also serves as an associate pastor at Bergen Park Church in Evergreen, Colorado, and is the author of Insanity, God, and the Theory of Knowledge. He recently moved back to the United States after serving for 11 years in France as a church planter and in ministry outreach to international students. Jonah has written an article for our Effective Evangelism column in Volume 44, Number 1, 2021 issue of the print edition of the Christian Research Journal. Our Effective Evangelism column is a practical advice column on how to reach people of other faiths and of no faith with the gospel. Authors with experience witnessing to adherents of a particular non-Christian or an unorthodox belief system share their knowledge with readers and give wisdom on approaches to breaking through the barriers that Christians commonly encounter with a particular group. His article in our 44 number one issue is called Faith, Fact, and Reason, Ingredients for Knowledge. You can read his article when you subscribe to our magazine at our website, equip.org, which is EQUIP.org. And you will receive this issue as your first issue. Jonah, it's good to have you on.
Hello, Melanie. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, today we're talking, as I mentioned, about Jonah's article in the current issue of the Christian Research Journal, and it's in our Effective Evangelism column. And as I said, it's something that we want to be very practical for people as they share the gospel with coworkers, family, friends, people around them. And so this particular one is a very fascinating one, and it might sound, you know, a little academic at first because the title is about faith, fact, and reason as ingredients for knowledge, but these are some really important topics for Christians to consider. So it seems to me right now that, you know, a lot of people who are not Christians or not religious at all often claim that religion, specifically Christianity, will pit faith against reason or faith against fact or faith against science. And so you couldn't believe in both of those things. So why does this continue to be such a popular, you know, argument that's used by skeptics or atheists against the fact that, of course, Christianity and its worldview could not be rational?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of reasons for this, but there seem to be at least three particular reasons this issue remains at the forefront of Christian apologetics. First of all, I guess I'd point back to the book of Ecclesiastes and the Koheleth, the author of Ecclesiastes, who said there's nothing new under the sun, right? So each generation seems in some ways doomed to really recycle the same worn out arguments ad infinitum. Each generation is asking the same questions. Each generation requires the same kinds of answers. This is really just human nature. So I think Christian apologists, Christians in general, whether you're a professional apologist or not, need to be aware that though we've given some good answers to these issues in the past, each generation is going to deal with this stuff. Secondly, I would say that the faith-reason dichotomy seems to be exacerbated by our basic ignorance of the structure of knowledge. And this is something I want to come back to later and expound on a little bit, because I think the structure of knowledge is really important. But if we had a better understanding of what knowledge is and how faith and reason and fact and all of these things fit into the knowledge structure as part of our cognitive attitude toward truth and reality, then I do really think that faith and reason or faith and fact may no longer appear to be at odds with one another. So really, I guess what I'm saying is that people need to be educated about epistemology. And epistemology is basically just the theory of knowledge in philosophy and in theology. So questions pertaining to faith, questions pertaining to reason, I think really fit into that discussion of the knowledge structure. A third thing I would say is that when religious skeptics target the Christian faith, they may not know exactly what it is they're targeting. And this seems to be an ongoing issue, because if the skeptic has chosen a bad or incomplete definition of faith, essentially he's going to find himself arguing against a straw man. And we see this a lot. There are a lot of definitions of faith, but religious skeptics and Christians really need to get on the same page as to what exactly they're talking about. A couple of years ago, this is a few years back, a philosopher by the name of Peter Boghossian had written a book that was fairly popular on street epistemology, you know, how to defeat the Christian in these arguments. And he defined faith as believing what you know to be false. Believing what you know to be false. Now, I don't think most Christians would accept that definition. Others have suggested that faith is belief without evidence or belief without reason. It's this kind of irrational leap, that sort of thing. Again, I don't think most Christians would view faith through that lens. And so Christians would most likely agree that faith is at least some sort of belief concerning a particular spiritual or historical or even future reality that's substantiated by a particular set of testimonies, by a particular set of experiences. So all that to say, I think we need to get clear as to what we're talking about when we engage with religious skeptics on issues related to faith and reason.
Well, I want to let our listeners know that Jonah just mentioned Peter Boghossian, and we actually did cover street epistemology and the new atheist evangelism. That's an article that you can read for free on our website, equip.org, that we published back in 2017. In addition, we also did a podcast. So if you would like to listen to our podcast about street epistemology, it's episode 76. If you missed it from several years ago, you can go back, because we're already, you know, past 230 episodes. So if you want to look for that one, you can go ahead on our website, equip.org, or go look at your feed for this podcast and find episode 76. Before I ask you our next question, you did use the word straw man. For some of our listeners that don't know what that is, could you please explain that?
Yeah, so basically a straw man argument, you're setting up, you could say maybe a false definition. You're basically putting someone or putting something in a box and then attacking that which is false. So that's really the idea behind a straw man argument. So you're taking a Christian belief that most Christians wouldn't believe, wouldn't advocate for, and then making arguments against that. So you're not really arguing against Christianity. You're arguing against your own perception of Christianity. So that's what I mean by straw man in that context.
So, you know, you're talking about this faith-reason dichotomy. Do you think there are ways in which Christians themselves have been responsible for contributing to this dichotomy that people perceive between faith and reason?
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned previously that religious skeptics often misunderstand what Christian faith is, and thus they argue against something that historic Christianity doesn't even endorse. We had just talked about that. But the problem is, I think sometimes this is worsened by Christians themselves. So Christians have sometimes unwittingly played into the hands of skeptics and contributed to this dichotomy by adopting a kind of anti-intellectualism. And I think this has been an ongoing issue in the church for a long time. And so this anti-intellectualism is where faith is, you could say, relegated to a kind of ethereal spiritual realm where the laws of logic don't apply, where observable truth is irrelevant, or that sort of thing. And here's what I mean by that. So instead of engaging with religious skeptics by showing them the relevancy of faith in guiding our thinking concerning everyday matters of truth and morality, sometimes we opt to protect faith from intellectual assault by taking the position that faith is irrational. So that's the idea. And I guess you could say, too, the idea is that if you can't rationally defend the truth of Christian belief, then in a way you can't rationally argue against it either. And so for a lot of Christians, I think in history, this is kind of a protective measure against the faith. So there was a Christian philosopher in the 19th century, Soren Kierkegaard, who was a well-known philosopher from Denmark, and he attempted something like this when he essentially argued that faith was kind of like a leap into the darkness. And so again, if faith is this subjective thing, if it's just a feeling, you really can't argue with that. The skeptic can't touch it. And so faith becomes immune to rational discourse. And so I think really at the root of this, I understand where Christians are trying to go. It's, like I said, protective against the faith, against Christian belief. But I don't think it's helpful as we engage with the world on these issues.
So I think when we're talking about evangelism, you know, how we define words when we talk to people and even ourselves as we approach this, it's really important. So do you think that Christians themselves can agree on, say, a working definition of faith, you know, in response to religious skepticism? And if so, what do you think that definition would look like?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. You know, there have been a lot of definitions of faith that have been put forth by Christian theologians and pastors over the years, and we don't have time to touch on all of those. But my particular focus here would be on faith as a doxastic category. Okay, and I'll explain what I mean by doxastic category. We talk about that a lot in epistemology, but that's essentially a mental state, a mental attitude toward truths concerning God and concerning his activity in time, space, history. So when I talk about doxastic, yeah, that's maybe a big word, but really just means a mental state or attitude towards something. So my focus as a philosopher has been on the aspect of faith that really pertains to how we think about things in the world. And that's a start. And it's important to understand this as a part of faith, but I think faith is more than just a mental attitude. Faith, as defined by that famous passage in the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 1, a lot of Christians are aware of this passage, but that's a good definition of faith, and it adds the element of trust. And so Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 defines faith as, well, as confidence of things hoped for, right? How does it go? Confidence of things hoped for and conviction or assurance of things not seen. And I think this definition seems to include both this, again, doxastic state or this intellectual assent, but also an element of trust concerning that which we may not be able to explicitly prove through empirical evidence. So what we need to be careful about is the claim that faith is irrational. So while faith may not appeal explicitly to the kinds of evidence that we might expect in ordinary situations, this doesn't rule out rational discourse or valid reasons for belief. And this really should help reiterate that the Bible defines faith as an attitude or action that aims at truth. And I think that's really important. We're not talking about wishful thinking here. We're not just making these things up. Our faith aims at truth. So in Abraham, for example, if you go back to toward the beginning of the Bible, to the book of Genesis, when Abraham believed God's promise, he didn't believe a lie, right? He didn't succumb to wishful thinking. He followed and committed himself to what he actually believed was the truth. And that truth was affirmed as Abraham walked with God and as God gradually revealed more about himself and his plan to Abraham. I also think that our reasons for trusting God are founded on what we know to be true about God's character. And again, that kind of points us back to the story of Abraham. God has acted in such a way in the past that we can have confidence in what he will do in the future. We might say that faith is kind of the belief that God, who has done what he said he would do, will actually continue to do or will do what he has not yet done, if that makes sense. In other words, God keeps his promises. So I think of these words of Martin Luther as well, who says that faith is a living, bold trust in God's grace. It's certainty of God's favor. So in sum, I think it's important to understand that faith is not a blind or imprudent leap into the darkness, into the unknown. I think it's a step into the light in many ways. Faith really belongs as much to knowledge as does other rational belief or reason-based acceptance of the truth. And so I guess I'd want to stick as much to the biblical examples and biblical definition as possible when I think about what faith is.
You're listening to episode 237 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today, I'm talking to Jonah Haddad, who has written an article for our Effective Evangelism column in the print edition of the Christian Research Journal, which is volume 44, number 1. And his article is called Faith, Fact, and Reason, Ingredients for Knowledge. And you can read his article when you get this issue as your first issue in your subscription to our magazine. You can subscribe to our magazine at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Well, I'd like to thank you for being a regular listener or welcome any new listeners to the podcast and ask that you partner with us. And one of the best ways to partner with us that I say every episode is to please rate and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts, where those reviews are stored. And that way, all the internet and computer algorithms can find our podcast better and suggest it to people looking for similar content. Please do share your favorite episodes on all of your social media accounts. And if a subscription for $33.50 is not in your budget right now, we'd appreciate it if you could give us a little tip. It helps us bring you this free podcast every week. And you can tip us when you go to our website, equip.org, and go to magazine at the drop-down, click on Postmodern Realities. You'll head to the landing page for all of our episodes, click on any of them, and you will find a link to tip us. And thank you for all the ways that you partner with us and just continue to tell a friend about this podcast. I want to go back to something that you said earlier in this podcast and ask you about the structure of knowledge, which you briefly mentioned. Can you just explain a little bit more for our listeners? What is it and why is it important?
Yeah, well, that's a really important question because I think that's really where the heart of the faith reason issue lies. And so, yeah, we need to spend some time on that and unpack that. Now, when we talk about faith and reason, we're talking about two different philosophical categories. And this is really important to understand. In fact, we're talking about two different components of knowledge. Now, both are critical to knowledge, but they're two different things. So these are both necessary to how we know the world. So faith as a mental state or as a cognitive category, as I mentioned earlier, is an important part of this. Reason is a little different. It refers to an explanation for why you might have a particular cognitive attitude. So the two coincide. You need both. And to understand this, I don't think it would hurt to actually go back through the history of philosophy briefly and examine some of the important events in the history of epistemology that help us get at what these ingredients for knowledge are. So historically, the Greeks spoke about this tripartite analysis of knowledge. So three elements to knowledge. And these three ingredients were necessary. So you needed justification, you needed truth, and you needed belief. So you knew something if you had a justified true belief. So for example, I'm seated at a table right now as we have this conversation. And in order to know that I'm seated at a table, it would need to actually be true that there is a table. That has to be a reality. It has to correspond to reality. I would also need to believe that there's a table here in front of me. And I would need to have some sort of evidence or some sort of justification for my belief in the table. And so since I can touch the table, since I can see the table, I'm aware of its presence here, I have a pretty good reason to believe that it's real. And I can rightly say, I know there's a table. Now, this was really the standard view of knowledge, these three ingredients. And this was really for centuries the standard view accepted by philosophers. Until the 1960s, a philosopher by the name of Edmond Gettier came along and he published a very short paper, which really just turned the world of epistemology upside down because he offered several counterexamples to this tripartite analysis of knowledge and basically showed that it's possible to have a justified true belief and still not have knowledge. This became known as the Gettier problem. Now, honestly, it's not crucial that we go into a lot of detail on Gettier's paper, but what's important here and the point is, philosophers began to realize that maybe other ingredients were needed, or maybe fewer ingredients were needed. But the point was that there were still a number of components that have to come together, that have to converge in order for a person to know things about the world. And so some philosophers talk about something like warrant instead of justification. Some philosophers talk about beliefs that aim at truth. And so they take out that element of justification or redefine it. Some philosophers talk about justified true belief, but then they add in, say, a pragmatic element as well. Others talk about replacing justification with entitlement or these kinds of things so that you're just basically entitled to believe certain things without having to provide evidential reason and so on. And none of those things are really that critical here. Really, my point is that philosophers still mostly agree that knowledge is made up of multiple components. And that's the big takeaway. That's, I think, really the important thing we need to focus on. So you have to have some sort of mental state, right? We talked about that. If you're going to know something, you have to believe something about it. You have to mentally accept something about that thing. And in the same way, you have to be able to provide at least some kind of reason for why you're right in believing or accepting that thing to be true. Again, you could point to evidence of some sort. Maybe your belief aims at truth. Maybe it seeks truth. So in my article for the Christian Research Journal, I use this metaphor of cake baking, and I think that'll help us kind of bring it down to a level we can understand. Now, I don't personally know a ton about baking cakes. I've eaten plenty of cakes in my lifetime. I do know that cakes are delicious, but here's my point. Cake can be reduced to parts, right? It consists of multiple essential components. Now, those components may vary greatly, and there are a lot of different types of cakes out there, but at a minimum, if you're going to have a cake, you have to have some sort of liquid, right? You need some sort of milk or, you know, maybe water or juice or yogurt or eggs or some kind of thing to kind of hold it together. You have to have some kind of starch, right? It's flour of some sort, whether it's wheat flour, white flour, coconut flour, whatever kind of thing people put in there. And then you need a sweetener because a cake wouldn't be a cake without sugar or honey or some kind of thing. These are the ingredients that make up a cake, and they belong to different categories. And my point here is that in the same way, knowledge is made up of ingredients. And faith, I think, is one of those ingredients in certain types of knowledge. Again, you need that mental state. You need a reality to which that mental state aims. You need some kind of reason that ties it all together. So that's the way I understand knowledge. And I really do think faith can fit into knowledge. And that's been part of the problem with this whole faith-fact dichotomy and the accusation that faith conflicts with fact and that sort of thing. No, I think they're both needed ingredients in our knowledge about the world and about God.
Well, we started out talking about the perception of this dichotomy that people think, you know, Christians and skeptics, but how do faith and reason specifically, how would they fit into that structure of knowledge? Because I think people still, they're trying to get their mind around how it's not a dichotomy. And specifically, you know, how would faith be part of knowledge? Because a lot of people who are skeptics see faith as something other. It's not something knowable. So therefore, it can't be proven. So it shouldn't have a discussion. We shouldn't be discussing faith and reason together.
Yeah, well, you know, let's go back to that metaphor and see kind of how these things fit. So again, in my article for the Christian Research Journal, I asked the reader to imagine two bakers. Let's just do that for a second. Well, imagine two bakers, and these two guys are in a heated argument about which ingredients are needed for the cake. Now, imagine that one baker is insistent, completely insistent that the cake recipe requires a cup of milk. You have to have milk if you're going to have the cake. Now, the other baker pipes up and flat out refuses and starts arguing with the other guy. And he's saying, well, you're out of your mind. The recipe requires a cup of flour. And so back and forth, these two guys are arguing, one insisting on milk and the other insisting on flour. Now, there's an obvious problem here. Anyone listening to this, you recognize the issue. The reality is both of these people are correct. If the cake is going to work, you need the milk, you need the flour. So when religious skeptics argue against Christian belief and they call it irrational, or they say that it's contrary to reason, they're inadvertently conflating categories. So the issue here is it's not flour versus milk, okay? It's not sugar versus eggs in our recipe. The fact is you need all of that stuff in order to have a good cake. So it's, again, if we move this metaphor back into this realm of knowledge, it's not faith versus fact or belief versus reason. Again, you need all of that stuff together to have knowledge about any physical or spiritual reality. So faith is a kind of belief. It's a kind of mental state. You need to have that thing attached to some sort of fact, attached to some sort of reason in order to know the world around you. So if the Christian and the religious skeptic are going to argue about anything, really what they should be arguing about is which mental state is driving their knowledge, right? And so it's not about Christian faith versus atheist reason, because again, that's a confusion of knowledge categories. What we want to compare and what we want to encourage people to compare as we're having these discussions with religious skeptics is that we're talking about Christian faith versus, you could say, atheist faith or Christian belief against atheist belief, if you prefer to put it that way. Or you could say we're comparing Christian reasons versus atheist reasons or Christian truth claims versus atheist truth claims, right? So when Christians claim to have knowledge about God, we're claiming that our mental attitude regarding spiritual realities is actually substantiated by some kind of reason, some kind of justification, and that that attitude is aimed at an actual truth. And so when the religious skeptic attempts to employ language that pits faith against reason, really, I think what we need to do is gently remind the skeptic that the conversation should center not on my faith against his reason, but rather my faith or belief in contrast to his faith or belief. We need to look at how our reasons for our beliefs compare to his reasons or her reasons for his or her belief. We need to talk about how our truth claims differ from his truth claims, right? So ultimately, people need to understand that faith versus reason is honestly a ridiculous and meaningless category confusion.
So by saying, you know, you're giving us this example, like, you know, recipe for a cake, which has all these different ingredients. So by saying that faith is an ingredient, like an ingredient to make a cake, which is, you know, just one ingredient among many. You can't just have one ingredient for cake. It has to have a bunch of different ones in order to make a good cake. So by saying that faith is like that ingredient for knowledge, is it correct to assume that faith must be substantiated, you just said, by justification or some kind of evidence or reason? In other words, can we have faith that's independent of evidence?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it's correct to suggest that faith is built on explicit evidence. And so the biblical examples of faith that we see tend to frame faith as stepping out in trust. Again, I'm thinking back to Hebrews 11. So we're stepping out in trust while seeking further understanding about God and about the world he has made. So I would even suggest that the rationality of faith is tied less to a body of empirical evidence and maybe more to the idea that faith in God is rooted in actual relationship with God. I think that's a really key component as well, especially as we think about evangelism. That's really the goal, is to bring people into relationship with God, not just to know facts about God. So faith as a belief can be justified on the basis that it is an aspect of relationship with a real personal being, namely God. So in the same way that I can know something because I trust the person whose testimony I'm believing, so too, I would say my justification for faith can be built on my relationship of trust with the very God whose testimony or promises I'm being asked to believe. In other words, I'm in relationship with a God who is real, and I think through that relationship, then I'm in some ways justified in my belief. On top of that, I think it's important to note that faith is a component of knowledge that aims at truth. I had alluded to that earlier, but faith is about truth. We can't forget that. Faith is about truth. So while faith may not employ the kind of evidence we may expect when we're doing, you know, scientific research, that kind of thing, faith is still about truth. It's a true belief about something or someone. Again, it's not wishful thinking. It's knowledge that engages the heart. I think it engages the head. It engages our experience, our perceptions of spiritual reality. It engages our relational position to God.
So you just said that faith is something that's engaging. You know, it's, first of all, it's rooted in relationship to God, and it engages the heart and the head along with, you know, our experience and our perception. And that's really helpful when talking to skeptics, because you noted that, you know, we need to explain that knowing God is about a relationship. So what about specific examples in scripture where we see this? Can you just kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think there are a number of examples in scripture. There's one I think I want to point to in particular, and I referenced this again in the article that I had written for the Christian Research Journal. One of my favorite examples of faith is this exchange that takes place between Jesus and the father of the demon-possessed boy in Mark chapter 9. It's a fascinating story, and it's a story that's always just kind of sat with me as a philosopher. I've wrestled with it. Just to give you a little background on the story, as it goes, a boy was afflicted with this demon or evil spirit who was physically harming him. He would throw him into fire and water and this sort of thing to try to kill him. But Jesus' disciples, when the boy was brought to them, were unable to drive the demon out. And so eventually the boy's father goes to Jesus. In desperation, he comes to Jesus to see, okay, maybe if the disciples can't drive out this demon, maybe Jesus can. And so he comes to him and requests the help of Jesus. And after this exchange, Jesus says, well, do you believe? And this is where the heart of it is, because the boy's father cries out in verse 24, I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief. That's a critical piece, I think, in the story. Now, some commentators on Mark's gospel have offered that this is simply a cry of desperation from a hurting father who wants his son healed. And I think they're right. I don't disagree with that. I think it's at least that. But I think it might be a little more than that as well. What this father is expressing in Mark chapter 9 is not completely foreign, I think, to the experiences of many modern day Christians. We go through difficult circumstances or times in our life where I wouldn't be surprised if our prayer sometimes is, I believe, but I'm still wrestling. Or I believe, but I'm actually not really sure that I believe. Or I believe, but not with the level of certainty that I'd like. I can personally relate to that. I think a lot of people can. And so understanding that doxastic or mental states such as faith, these are complex things. I think beliefs can be gradable in that they can be held with various degrees of certainty. Maybe you feel sometimes like you're 90% sure, or you're 85% sure, that sort of thing. Beliefs can be held involuntarily. Honestly, when we're presented with something so real, so evident, so substantive that we don't really have to decide whether we're going to adopt it as truth. And examples of this abound, I think, all the time around us. For example, I'm not doing any mental work right now in deciding whether or not I'm having a conversation with you. That's just not something I have to think about. It's part of my mental state, my mental attitude. I believe it because it just is. It's what's happening. In fact, it would be strange if I were to sit here and ponder whether or not we're having a conversation. That would be a little weird. If I did that, you might think I was out of my mind. So a lot of beliefs are just involuntary. It's just the way it is. Beliefs just happen. However, at other times, I think we have to carefully evaluate what we see and what we hear, and we need to make difficult decisions as to whether we will accept what we see and hear. We do this naturally with, say, eyewitness testimonies. We have to think about that a little bit. Do I trust the person who told me this? Is this credible? With possible outcomes, we have to assess those things. What might future facts look like, contingencies, that sort of thing, or historical facts. Some historical facts may appear to us as outrageous, and so we need to spend a little time researching or thinking through it or seeking out whether or not we're going to adopt a particular belief about that thing into our cognitive attitude. So sometimes we think we saw something out of the corner of our eye. That's another example We have to pause and think, hey, did I see what I think I saw? And so that's where the complexity of belief really lies. And I think Mark 9 really captures that. You know, at what level of certainty did the boy's father believe in Jesus? Was this involuntary? Was it a voluntary belief? Beliefs, again, are very complex. So I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that the father of the demon-possessed boy in Mark 9 was really honestly struggling to decide what he really wanted to accept into his cognitive categories. He might have assented intellectually to some realities about Jesus based on what he had seen and heard from others. He may have been waiting to receive an indubitable belief, you know, some fact undeniable that only God himself could provide. I think this father may have been struggling to correctly situate his mustard seed faith in light of the complexity of the world around him. But what's important in the passage is that whatever faith he had was directed at Jesus Christ. It was directed at the only person who could substantiate that faith.
Well, let's get really practical. So what are some ways that Christians can engage with religious skeptics, you know, specifically as we've been talking about, who object to Christianity and you know, think that faith is contrary to reason, as we've talked about? How can we effectively and winsomely engage with them?
Yeah, well, let me go back and I guess just summarize a few things that we can do to make this work for us practically as we talk to religious skeptics. Because I think we all know people who have raised some really good and legitimate questions, and we want to know how to engage with that. I would say that most importantly, we need to find some common terminology. Now, we spend a lot of time today talking about faith, defining faith, how does faith fit into knowledge and all of that stuff. The thing with faith, though, it's a word that's encumbered by ambiguity, right? It's encumbered by hermeneutical baggage. You know, there are a lot of views of it, interpretations of it, that sort of thing. Rather than trying to define faith for the skeptic, it may honestly be better to use words like belief that are more common. Just bring it down to terms that people can relate to. And this way, the Christian isn't as easily put into a box of having irrational faith in opposition to the skeptic's rationally held fact, right? You start to talk as if you're on the same page together. So when you're engaging with the religious skeptic in rational discourse, your starting point is a comparison of beliefs. So you're saying, I believe this about ultimate reality. And it sounds like you believe that about ultimate reality. So let's talk about the reasons we hold those incompatible beliefs. That way it's not I have faith and you have fact, right? It's my belief against your belief. Let's talk, let's compare, let's wrestle together with these issues. So you don't want to have to compare apples with oranges. You don't want to compare the wrong categories. You want to compare good apples with bad apples, right? You want to compare better apples with less preferable apples. That's where you want to be. So you need to get on the same page with your terminology. Secondly, I think we need to be careful not to let the religious skeptic use the accusation of Christian irrationality as an excuse not to engage in conversation. This has happened to me on several occasions. You see, when Christians talk about God, we're talking about truth claims concerning reality. We're talking about historical facts such that Jesus is God incarnate, that he died on a cross, right? That he was raised to life by the power of the Holy Spirit, that eyewitnesses accurately related these facts by the inspiration of the Spirit in Scripture. Now, a few years ago, I was working with a church. This was actually over in France when I was working there as a church planter. I was working at the church and we were hosting a debate on the question of God's existence. Is there a God? And to help kind of advertise this, we had gone out to one of the local universities and we were sharing pamphlets with students, inviting them to this talk, this debate. And I remember one young man in particular, he said to me, I'm not interested. I'm a philosophy student. That's it. I'm not interested. I'm a philosophy student. And that was the end of the discussion. At the time, I didn't really know what to make of that. It took me some time to think through what he meant there. But I think this was really just another way of saying, you have faith, I have reason, there's no need to discuss. You're irrational, I'm rational. To me, that's a cop-out. That's bad philosophy. So again, I think we can't let people get away with that. We need to question those kinds of attitudes when we come up against that. And ultimately, I think we need to do good epistemology, right? We need to do our homework by understanding the ingredients for knowledge that we're using as we form knowledge about physical and spiritual realities. We need to challenge religious skeptics to also work with the right kinds of ingredients for knowledge, because a lot of times Christians, we're confused about how this stuff works. We don't get it right. You have to realize a lot of religious skeptics, they're confused as well. They may just be repeating things that they've heard, this faith fact dichotomy. That's just a common thing people throw at Christians. So if we're going to have meaningful conversations with religious skeptics, we need to lovingly invite them to speak the same philosophical language. Now, where those conversations focus, now that's going to depend on each individual. You might talk about the existence of God. You might be having a conversation about the historicity of the New Testament or the resurrection of Jesus or so on. But the point is that you define faith biblically. You dissuade the skeptic from separating faith from fact, and you point people to ultimately the good news that Jesus Christ lived in history, that he died for sinners and skeptics, that he was raised to life so that we too, by faith, can live eternally in the presence of God.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Jonah. So Jonah, what's your favorite meal?
Oh, my favorite meal is, it's got to be Lebanese food, Middle Eastern food. I have Lebanese background. And so, yeah, I love that food when I can get a hold of it.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
I'm definitely an introvert.
Are you an early bird or a night owl?
I love to get up early and get my day started as the sun is coming up. So early bird for sure.
And if you didn't need to sleep, what would you do with the extra time?
I would probably read. I love books, so I'd be up reading.
And finally, you live in Colorado. So what's your favorite thing about living there?
Well, I'm living in the mountains, so I love to get out and hike. I've got trails in my backyard, and you'll often see me out hiking. So,
well, thank you, Jonah, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 237 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Jonah Haddad, who has written an article in the print edition of our magazine, Volume 44, Number 1, in 2021, in the Effective Evangelism column. And his article is called Faith, Fact, and Reason, Ingredients for Knowledge. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comment section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org, because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.